This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Ryan Lizza profiles Michelle Bachmann in the current edition of The New Yorker. His article, Leap of Faith, is in part about Bachmann's transformation from Tea Party insurgent to serious Republican Party contender in the 2012 presidential race. The article is also about how she developed her Christian convictions and how they have shaped her right-wing politics. Lizza traveled with Bachmann in mid-June on a borrowed corporate jet she used to get to Iowa to campaign for the caucuses. Ryan Lizza is covering the presidential campaign for The New Yorker. Ryan Lizza, welcome back to Fresh Air. What are some of the positions that you would say define Michelle Bachmann politically?
Well, if you look at her legislative career in the state Senate, the issues that she was the most well-known for were opposition to gay marriage, fighting for the display of the Ten Commandments in public places, and railing against federal education policy, which she partly thought lacked rigor. That was one component of it. But also she thought it was, as she has said, anti-biblical. She takes her Christianity very seriously. She comes out of a religious, evangelical, conservative movement that is very much concerned with developing a biblical worldview and applying it to all corners of one's life.
You write that one of the things she's best known for is her habit of casting outlandish aspersions on her ideological foes and then having to reel back those statements with a ritual apology. And you actually witnessed two examples of that when you were traveling on her campaign plane in June. What were those examples?
Well, I mean, the first thing I should say is I truly don't mean this in any partisan way, but this is the fourth presidential campaign I've covered. I've been covering politics since 1997. And I've never really covered a candidate sort of at her level who, frankly, makes so many misstatements when so many factual misstatements. She's fairly careless with the facts. I'll just give you one example, and I think this example is quite interesting because you can sort of see a text from which Michelle Bachmann took a series of facts, and then you can watch her give a speech based strictly on that text, and then you can sort of compare the two. And the story isn't that important, but she is, of course, a very strong candidate in Iowa, is really emphasizing her Iowa roots. She was born in Iowa, and she has a long history of ancestors who are from Iowa. And so she told a story about how her ancestors came to the United States from Norway, and she tells a series of dramatic stories about their flight from Norway to Iowa, floods, bad weather, locusts, this and that. And then they finally persevere and survive and live happy lives. But all of the dramatic stories she told that she told her audience happened in Iowa actually happened in Wisconsin and South Dakota. And so I was in the And her cousin actually wrote a family history where he very clearly laid out the facts of her family moving to Wisconsin and then moving to South Dakota and these dramatic things happening in South Dakota, and then her family leaving the frontier of South Dakota for the relative safety and civilization of Iowa. And in Bachmann's hands, this became a story of just botched facts and misstated narrative. And I'll be honest with you, that sort of blew me away when I sat there and looked at the text she took this from and how she delivered the speech. And that may seem like a trivial example, but when you're running for president, these things really do matter.
Did you call her on that? Did you tell her that you'd read the family history and that you got the facts wrong?
You know, I didn't, and I get at this a little bit in the piece. I spent 4 days on her campaign plane. She had a very small plane where everyone was basically in one cabin, where I was able to sort of report and observe how she and her campaign aides interacted really up close, really, frankly, in a sort of unprecedented way when it comes to presidential campaigns. You don't really get to see the inner workings of a campaign like this. And so I had some very short conversations with her on board there. Later, though, at the end of my reporting, I did interview her. And a lot of the issues that I talk about in the piece, I didn't get to because after about 20 minutes, she cut me off And she told me that she had to go do Sean Hannity's show on Fox News, and she couldn't talk anymore, but she would get back with me. And then later, her press secretary told me that she didn't like my line of questions, so she wasn't going to resume the interview. So some of the stuff that is talked about in the piece, I didn't actually get to ask her, including the example I cited about her story about her ancestors in Iowa.
Do you have a sense of what it was about your line of questions that she objected to?
You know, it's a good question. I looked over the transcript again to try and figure it out. It's probably one of two things. I did ask her, one of the important moments in her life that she's talked about with a great deal of emotion before is, she's used this phrase, she has said she came from a broken home. And her parents, the reason, she lived in Iowa until she was 12 years old, and then her father and her mother separated and then divorced. And she's talked about the divorce as the most sort of shattering experience of her young life. And not long after her parents divorced, she joined a prayer group. And that prayer group led her to become a born-again Christian. And she's talked very movingly and in great detail about the moment she was born again. And it all sort of started... her sort of road to being born again started with this sort of shattering of her family life. And one of the interesting things she's noted, at least when she spoke in front of one church audience, was how she didn't have a father. She didn't have a strong male figure in her life. But when she became born again, as she said, she then had a father. So she's talked about this very moving experience of losing her own dad and finding God, and she's connected the two in a very clear way. And so I started to ask her a bit about that, and she didn't want to talk about it with me. The next set of questions that I asked her were more about her intellectual influences. And she's cited over the years a number of people who have had a profound effect on forming her ideology. And as I started to get into the weeds of who these people are and what they believe, that's when the interview, it seemed like she was not as interested in talking about that.
Let's talk about some of those people who have had a profound influence on her ideas about Christianity and how Christianity relates to politics. Because Christianity, I think it's fair to say, is at the center of her political and social views, yes?
Without a doubt. And frankly, I think a lot of political journalists are uncomfortable in talking about someone's religious views and how they relate to their politics. You know, and often we treat religion or one's faith as, you know, a sort of box that as political journalists, we shouldn't open.
Something that's too personal.
Exactly. It's one's faith, no matter what they believe. It's really not relevant to their political views. But when you have someone who at every turn talks about how there's nothing more important in their life than their faith and how it relates to all of their politics, you know, I don't see how you could write about their thinking, their philosophy, their intellectual formation without trying to understand how religion moves them. So, you know, that's a lot of what the piece is about, and a lot of what I tried to do is explore the writers that she has cited as really helping form her.
So Michelle Bachmann is born again in high school. She meets her husband, Marcus, in college. They both first support Jimmy Carter, who was a born-again candidate. But then she's influenced by the teachings of the evangelist and theologian Francis Schaeffer and by his film series, How Should We Then Live? So it sounds from the piece like you watched the film series. You describe the first five installments as being like an art history and philosophy course taught by a Puritan. Give us an overview of some of the main points that you took away from this series that you think had an impact on Michelle Bachmann.
Yeah, so Schaeffer is a fascinating figure, and he was a very important evangelical thinker in the 70s. Ralph Reed once credited, the former Christian Coalition leader once credited Schaeffer with encouraging a whole generation of evangelicals to get involved with politics. And so a lot of Schaeffer's philosophy was about applying a sort of Christian worldview to Western history. So Schaefer will, in the first five episodes of his famous film series, he takes the audience through the entire history of Western culture from Rome, and then by the end of the movie, all the way up through Roe v. Wade. And the beginning chapters of this movie are all about where Christianity took wrong turns. And for Schaefer, it's the Enlightenment, it's the Italian Renaissance, it's Darwinism, it's secular humanism. It's any point in history where he believes that man turns away from God and turns away from putting God at the center of life to putting humankind at the center of life. That's sort of his big point. What happened with Schaefer, though, is he becomes completely radicalized in 1973, and his focus completely changes. So in 1973, when Roe versus Wade abortion decision comes down, Schaefer decides that all of his philosophy and all of this history that he'd been teaching for years about the dangers of moving away from a Christ-centered world, everything he warned about is now coming to fruition with this Roe decision, that the government is becoming, in his terms, being taken over by an authoritarian elite. And you actually see this radicalizing moment show up in his film series. The first few episodes really are about art and culture. And then the last episodes take a very conspiratorial and frankly paranoid turn. And the sort of iconic scene in the second half of the series is a government van driving around with a funny-looking guy and a fake mustache pouring chemicals in the water supply of a city as Schaefer narrates that perhaps the government could be using drugs to control the population. I mean, it really takes a completely different turn. And so I emphasize this just to sort of show this is the movie that Michelle Bachmann says changed her life. This is the movie that got her radicalized on the abortion issue. And, you know, to understand her, I think you have to understand Schaefer a little bit. By the end of his life, right before he died, Schaefer published a very influential book called A Christian Manifesto. And in that book, by the end of that book, he's actually laying down the groundwork by which Christian activists, and especially anti-abortion activists, may need to resort to the use of force.
The use of force?
The use of force. I mean, literally, as his son Frank, who was who was very close to his father, and was and carried on his father's teachings after his father died in 1984, but then eventually left the religious conservative movement, and you know is no longer a Schaeferite, to say the least. As his son said, you know, by the end of his dad's life, his dad was calling for the violent overthrow of the U.S. government.
No, Bachmann was also influenced by a student of Schaefer's, Nancy Piercy, who was she a proponent of Schaefer's view of dominionism, that Christians were biblically mandated to occupy all secular institutions until Christ returns?
Yeah, now Piercy, from what I can tell, is sort of one of the leading modern proponents of Schaefer's philosophy. Piercy actually studied with Schaefer in Switzerland and has sort of continued on with his line of thinking. And the reason I brought her into the piece is that Michelle Bachmann has mentioned Piercy's book as one that was important to her. And I actually did ask her about that, and she told me it was a wonderful book. So Piercy wrote a book a number of years ago called Total Truth. It's in line with the sort of Schaeferite view of taking your Christian faith and making sure that it permeates all parts of your life. The key thing here is Christians should not just be go to church on Sundays Christians, but their religion should permeate all aspects. And Piercy actually calls this the cultural mandate. She uses the same line from Genesis to rest this idea on, and again argues that your faith needs to permeate your life.
Well, I guess what I'm wondering is she saying your faith needs to permeate your life, or your faith needs to permeate the United States government?
Well, she would say that it needs, if you're a dentist, then you have to figure out a way to have your faith permeate your dentist practice. If you're a politician, your faith should permeate what you do as a politician, that there's really no distinction between the two, and that the great problem for Christianity is that Christians separate these two things.
So do you think that Michelle Bachmann subscribes to the view that you say Francis Schaeffer eventually subscribed to, which is that Christians are biblically mandated to occupy all secular institutions until Christ returns?
She's never said that specifically, but if you look at her history, if you look at the first time she actually got involved with politics, and that is when she started a charter school in her local town of Stillwater, Minnesota. It was only a 6 or 7 month experiment. She got together with some parents. They started a publicly funded charter school, signed a charter that said that they were not allowed in any way to include a sectarian religious agenda at this school, and they very quickly violated that and built the school around a Christian sectarian agenda, to the point where parents who were told that this was a school for at-risk kids became very alarmed because their children were being taught creationism, and famously they were not allowed to watch the movie Aladdin because it involved magic, and on and on, and were eventually, the school district stepped in and warned them that they were going to lose their charter because they were violating it, and eventually Bachmann and another person who were sort of spearheading this were forced off the board and forced off the leadership of that school. So that's a great example of, to me at least, Bachmann's view of what Piercy would call the cultural mandate, sort of running head-on into the separation of church and state that exists in our schools.
Michelle Bachmann went to Oral Roberts University, and you asked her if her views were fully consistent with the prevailing ideology at Oral Roberts. What was the prevailing ideology at Oral Roberts University when she was there?
Well, so she was part of the first law school class at Oral Roberts. The school was actually called the Coburn School of Law. And it's a law school that taught its students biblical law, that you need to understand the Bible, you need to understand biblical law, and that's what the United States Constitution is built upon. And as a legal mind, you should understand when American law is and is not consistent with biblical law. I actually asked one of her former professors, John Eidsmo, someone whom she was a research assistant for, what does this mean? What does it mean that, you know, when you're studying biblical laws? I said, well, you know, what happens if biblical law conflicts with American law? What do you do? And he said, well, the first thing you would be taught at Coburn is to do everything you can to change the American law.
So Michelle Bachmann was not only a student, a professor, John Eidsmo, she was also a research assistant for him. And you asked him if he thought that her views were consistent with a book that he wrote called Christianity and the Constitution. And he told you that he thought her views were consistent with the book. What are the views in that book?
Well, the book is ostensibly a explanation of how most of the founders were Christians, and how their Christianity influenced their political thinking and specifically the Constitution. And so he has, I forget how many, I think 13 chapters, one each on 13 of the founders. And it's just his sort of excavation of their religious beliefs and how they used their religious beliefs to apply it to the Constitution. That's a big part of the book. But really, by the end of the book, what Eidsmo is talking about is how evangelical Christians need to get politically active, and they need to get involved with the legal system, and they need to make sure that American law is more biblically based. I mean, that's what the book ends on. He has sort of a clarion call for his students to get involved. And that wouldn't mean much. I mean, I'd had some wacky professors in college, frankly, that I wouldn't want someone to associate with my own views today. And so I want to be careful to point out that I'm not saying that, I'm not just cherry-picking this guy. This is someone that Michelle Bachmann specifically to this day mentions as a very important influence on her as recently as this spring in a speech in Iowa.
Michelle Bachmann describes herself as a former federal tax litigation attorney, and on her website bio, it says she spent 5 years as a federal tax litigation attorney working on hundreds of civil and criminal cases. That experience solidified her strong support for efforts to simplify the tax code and reduce tax burdens on families and small business budgets. But you spoke to some of her former colleagues And they gave you a different impression of her than the one she gives.
Yeah, so I talked to six people who worked with her in this small IRS office in St. Paul, Minnesota. They all had the exact same story about her time in that office. And nothing, you know, nothing really earth-shattering, just that she was fresh out of law school. She was young, inexperienced, not really focused on a legal career, not one of the best lawyers in the office, and partly because she was new and inexperienced, but also it was a time in her life where she was much more focused on her family than a law career. And I will say this, I think this is one of the more controversial parts of the piece, because I think she was the victim to a certain extent of some sexism in that job, because everyone complained to me that she wasn't in the office much because she was on maternity leave.
Twice.
And I never really got to ask her about this because she didn't respond to questions about this. But that was the impression that she left with her colleagues there, that she wasn't around much, wasn't very experienced, and was much more focused on raising her family than on her career.
Well, you do point out that for somebody who is so opposed to government, to some government benefits, she collected generous government benefits while she was working.
For someone whose ideology is really defined by a strong dislike for government, if you look at the way that she's supported herself over the years, it's mostly through the government. So after law school, she goes to work for the IRS. She's there for 4 years. Then in 1992, she starts taking in foster children and does that from 92 to 98 and is paid by the state to do that. She then works briefly for a local charter school, and then she starts running for office and becomes first a employee of the state of Minnesota and then, of course, a congresswoman, so an employee of the federal government. On top of that, as has been well reported, her husband is a psychologist, has two counseling clinics that, of course, like any other medical professional, you know, takes lots of money from the government medical, from Medicaid and Medicare. And then on top of that, you know, has received some generous farm subsidies for a farm he owns in Wisconsin. So if you actually went through the dollar amount of income that the Bachmans have from government sources, it would be pretty significant.
I think it's fair to say that a lot of your piece is kind of like the intellectual biography of Michele Bachmann, the professors that shaped her, the books that shaped her.
Well,
And one of the books I was really surprised to read about, which I hadn't heard of before, is a biography of Robert E. Lee, written by J. Stephen Wilkins, published in 1997. Part of it has to do with slavery, and I want to read a paragraph that you quote. "Slavery, as it operated in the pervasively Christian society, which was the Old South, was not an adversarial relationship founded upon racial animosity. In fact, it bred, on the whole, not contempt, but over time, mutual respect. This produced a mutual esteem of the sort that always results when men give themselves to a common cause. The credit for this startling reality must go to the Christian faith, the unity and companionship that existed between the races in the South prior to the war was the fruit of a common faith."
So this one sort of blew me away, because you have to ask yourself, and first of all, let me just point out why this book is relevant. For a number of years, Michele Bachmann's personal website had a list of books that she recommended people read, and it was called Michele's Must Read List. And so I was looking over the list and noticed this biography of Lee by Wilkins. Never heard of Wilkins. Started looking into who he was, and frankly couldn't believe that she was recommending this book. So Wilkins, he's done something very unique. He's combined a Christian conservatism with neo-Confederate views and developed what is known as the theological war thesis. And this is an idea that holds. The best way to understand the Civil War is actually to see it in religious terms, and that the South was an Orthodox Christian nation attacked by the godless North, and that what was really lost after the Civil War was one of the pinnacles of Christian society. And this, so what I discovered is that this insane view of the Civil War has been successfully injected into some of the Christian homeschooling movement curriculums with the help of this guy Wilkins. And my guess, I don't know this for sure because I didn't get to ask Michelle Bachman, my guess is that this is how she probably encountered Wilkins at some point, because she's not from the South. There's no history of her being interested in Southern heritage or anything else. And so I'm assuming that, that's how she was introduced to it. Either way, she recommended this book on her website for a number of years. It is an objectively pro-slavery book. And to me, one of the most startling things I learned about her in the reporting of this piece.
Do you think that the kind of Christian views that were expressed in the books that helped shape her faith and that helped shape her intellectually and helped shape her view of government are being expressed by her in her campaign now?
You know, it depends on the audience she's speaking to. In this spring, when she was doing some sort of less headline-making visits to Iowa and speaking at churches and sort of not—I don't want to say covertly, but under the radar, sort of wooing some of the religious leadership in Iowa. She knows how to speak that language, and she knows how to draw on her history at Oral Roberts and her born-again experience and her story about watching Schaefer's series of movies and how that changed her life. She knows how to tell all those stories so that an evangelical audience will, in a certain sense, bond with her. I think she did that early this year when she wasn't an announced candidate. Most of those voters know that background, and she doesn't really need to sell herself to those voters anymore. So she's transitioned, and she's transitioned into a candidate that talks much, much more about debt and spending and all the sort of libertarian economic issues that are so important to the Tea Party movement right now.
So what's your takeaway from having done this profile of Michelle Bachman? What did you learn about her that you didn't know before?
I understand her a little bit better. I think I understand her complete confidence in her own worldview, which she believes is grounded in the Bible. I understand how sometimes she is impervious to ideas and information that are sort of outside the bubble of her worldview. I understand where that comes from now. And I understand when she says something sort of that I might have thought of just outrageous and shook my head at, I understand intellectually and philosophically a little bit better where it's coming from.
So that imperviousness to other people's points of views that you referred to, where you said you understand where that comes from now.
Well, you know, I don't want to say that everything that is written in a book that she recommends means that she believes it, right? You don't want to do that. What I was very careful to do is look at the thinkers that she cited as the most influential in her own life. But there was one line from this Piercy book that she cited as important to her.
This is Nancy Piercy.
This is Nancy Piercy, who writes basically that believers need to be very, very careful when adopting ideas from non-believers. That even if once in a while, this is not an exact quote, but I'm paraphrasing, even if once in a while non-believers get a fact wrong, it will always in some way be tainted by the non-Christian worldview it comes out of. And I think, frankly, if that is what you believe, it's very hard to absorb thinking and ideas from outside your own worldview if you believe that everything else is tainted if it comes from non-believers.
Ryan, Lizza, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me, Terry. I really appreciate it.
Ryan Lizza is covering the presidential campaign for The New Yorker. His profile of Michelle Bachman is in the current edition of The New Yorker. You'll find a link to it on our website, freshair.npr.org. Coming up, the man behind the anti-Sharia movement in the U.S. We talk with New York Times investigative reporter Andrea Elliott. This is Fresh Air. Alarms are being sounded about the threat that Sharia law, Islamic law, poses to our legal system and our way of life. Michelle Bachman signed a pledge to reject Sharia Islam. Sarah Palin and Newt Gingrich have warned against Sharia law. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie had to defend his appointment of an American Muslim to the Superior Court against critics who charged the judge might rule according to Sharia law. Since last year, more than two dozen states have considered measures to restrict judges from consulting Sharia or foreign and religious laws. The statutes have been enacted in three states. My guest, Andrea Elliott, has investigated the roots of this movement. She wrote a recent article in the New York Times titled "The Man Behind the Anti-Sharia Movement." That man, she says, is David Yerushalmi, a little-known lawyer who has worked with a cadre of conservative public policy institutes and former military intelligence officials to write reports, file lawsuits against the government, and draft model legislation, all with the effect of casting Sharia as one of the greatest threats to American freedom since the Cold War. Andrea Elliott, welcome to Fresh Air. Before we talk about what the perceived threat is, let's just start with what is Sharia law?
Sure. Thanks for having me. I think part of the challenge here is that it's an incredibly complex topic. Sharia literally means the way to the watering hole and is more commonly referred to in shorthand as the way. And it is, most simply put, the legal code that guides Islamic beliefs and actions. But when Westerners think of a legal code, they tend to think of a fixed set of laws, and Sharia is a lot more fluid than that, because in part because there's no governing authority, no Vatican in Islam. So while Islam's four major schools of law agree on many basic areas of Sharia, there are many areas that lack consensus, and really just this whole spectrum of ways in which Muslims around the world observe Islamic law. And I think one of the key points that's been missing from this debate is that for Muslims living in non-Muslim countries like the United States, there is broad agreement that Sharia, in fact, obligates them to abide by the laws of the land in exchange for the right to worship freely. So I think those are some of the nuances that have been missing from this public outcry.
So you say the man behind the anti-Sharia law movement is David Yerushalmi, a 56-year-old Hasidic Jew with a history of controversial statements about race, immigration, and Islam. Tell us more about who he is.
Well, he's a complicated character, and he was a relatively obscure figure before all of this. His history of controversial statements has brought a lot of criticism to him, most notably from the Anti-Defamation League, a prominent Jewish organization. But all the while, he's managed to stay somewhat behind the scenes as this whole movement took hold. So what was intriguing to me was how this man, who was really a fringe figure, came to cultivate allies and influence people at such high levels, former military and intelligence officials, leaders of national organizations, presidential candidates. How did he make that leap? And I think part of the answer is that in person, he comes across not as the erratic character that some might expect, but as a sophisticated man who is convinced by his ideas and who has a kind of endless appetite for defending those ideas, the primary idea being that Islamic law poses a totalitarian threat to the West. So I think if I were to sum up sort of his argument, it's that you can't understand Sharia as simply an expression of faith, but as this broader program that seeks world domination, that as a legal military political system that seeks world domination.
In trying to investigate the question of how did Yerushalmi become so connected to people in politics and national security, you make the connection between him and Frank Gaffney, the president of the Center for Security Policy, a conservative think tank. Mm-hmm. And Gaffney himself argued after President Obama nominated Elena Kagan to the Supreme Court that Kagan had to be investigated because of her possible support of Sharia law. And he said that he thought that Obama might secretly be a Muslim. So what is the connection between Gaffney and Yerushalmi?
Their partnership began years ago when Yerushalmi, who had just started a nonprofit organization that really became his platform for opposing Sharia, kind of reached out to Gaffney because he was looking to raise funds for a study that he wanted to lead that would kind of examine mosques and whether there was a connection between what he calls Sharia-adherent behavior and support for violence. And so Gaffney really became his bridge to a whole network of think tanks and government, current, then current and former government officials including ultimately Jim Woolsey, the former director of Central Intelligence. And he really, they kind of set out together to launch this effort. I mean, I would say Gaffney catapulted Yerushalmi onto a new platform of influence. And their aim seems to have been really to try to get people in circles of influence to understand Sharia in this totally new frame, which is to say that it was, you know, they presented it as a totalitarian threat akin to what the United States faced during the Cold War. And so they, Yerushalmi in particular, kind of found different targets. One was the industry of Islamic finance. That led to meetings that Gaffney set up at the Department of Treasury. And I think those meetings in 2008 really marked a turning point for Gaffney and Yerushalmi, because up until then they were trying to figure out how to influence people at high levels of government, but the briefings went nowhere, and so they began looking for other avenues just as the Tea Party movement was taking off. And Yerushalmi saw an opening there in the sense that people were calling for smaller government, greater state autonomy, and so he started to focus on state legislatures, and in the summer of 2009, he began drafting the model legislation that would later sweep across the country. And so as he was putting the finishing touches on this law in preparation for a rollout in 2010, Gaffney was organizing conference calls with activists and getting people on board from organizations around the country, groups like the Eagle Forum, Tea Party groups, Act for America, which is a group that has 170,000 members and describes itself as opposed to radical Islam, although its critics argue that it's a central force in stirring up anti-Muslim sentiment across the country. And ACT really emerged as a key player in this, as did a newer nonprofit that began recruiting dozens of lawyers across the country to work with legislative committees or to sponsor the bills. And so then it first passed in Tennessee in May of 2010, and then Louisiana, and more recently in Arizona. And by the summer and fall of 2010, I think this whole message had gained new prominence.
So what do the state anti-Sharia laws have in common? Like, what is the model legislation?
The proposed laws vary from state to state, but they all basically restrict judges from considering Sharia or the broader category of religious or foreign or international laws. So it's hard to say what the legal impact of these laws will be. The Establishment Clause of the Constitution prevents the government from favoring or targeting one religion. The Oklahoma Amendment, which singles out Sharia, has been temporarily blocked by a federal judge pending the outcome of a lawsuit that argues that it infringes on religious freedom. But the three other laws that have passed in Tennessee and Louisiana and Arizona are worded neutrally enough that they could withstand constitutional scrutiny. I mean, what they do is they essentially restrict judges from upholding foreign laws that violate constitutional rights, which critics argue is already the standard.
So David Yerushalmi, the man who you say is behind this movement to introduce anti-Sharia laws into the states, you know, at the state level, he says that part of his goal is to prevent, Sharia from taking over. But he's also said part of his goal is to just get people asking the question, what is Sharia?
That's right. I think that's one of the more interesting facts of this is that, you know, he really set out on what might have seemed like an impossible mission, which was to make this very arcane and complex subject of Sharia a focus of national scrutiny. This is a word that was not even a part of our vernacular a few years ago. So just the idea that you could get Americans to talk about Islamic law when Islam itself remains a subject that is so little understood in this country would seem like a tall order. But the leaders of this campaign really talk about it in a more sort of preemptive way than a prescriptive way. What they say they're doing is that they're trying to prevent Sharia from having the kind of influence seen in Europe, particularly in England, where the Muslim immigrant community is far less integrated and where there are formal Sharia tribunals, where even just recently a group of hardline conservative Muslims launched a campaign calling for Sharia-controlled zones. So So here in the U.S., among supporters of the anti-Sharia message, there is this tendency to look at England as a harbinger of things to come. And as evidence of that, municipal pools in Seattle, for instance, that have adopted special hours to accommodate Muslim women so they don't have to swim in the presence of men. And those kinds of accommodations are obviously a far cry from the harsh form of Sharia that is practiced in Afghanistan and Somalia, where you can be executed for leaving the Islamic faith, or where you hear of rape victims being stoned to death for committing adultery. But implicit in the message of the anti-Sharia movement here is that asking for female-only hours at the pool is like the first step towards establishing a Muslim political order. And, you know, as one prominent Muslim American leader put it to me, that's why we left those countries.
So recently, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, who's a Republican, had to defend his decision to nominate a Muslim judge to the state superior court. Critics were warning that this new judge was going to implement Sharia law. And Christie said, Sharia law has nothing to do with this at all. It's crazy. It's crazy. This guy's an American citizen who has been an admitted lawyer to practice in the state of New Jersey, swearing an oath to uphold the laws of New Jersey, the Constitution of the state of New Jersey, and the Constitution of the United States. This Sharia law business is crap. It's just crazy, and I'm tired of dealing with the crazies. So that's what Governor Christie said. What did you think about when you heard this? Did you hear this as being connected to the anti-Sharia law movement that you write about in the New York Times?
I thought it was certainly a kind of watershed moment in the sense that no one in the Republican Party had spoken out against this so forcefully until then. Mitt Romney had distanced himself a little bit from it during the recent Republican debate among presidential candidates when others were speaking in support of it. But there was this tremendous reaction to what Christie said, I think in part because among critics of this movement, there was a sense that he gave voice to what they've been feeling has sort of been lacking from public commentary about this, which is the sense that it is crazy, that it is, you know, coming out of nowhere, that it's extreme.
Tell me if you think this is a fair analogy or not in terms of understanding Sharia law as practiced in the United States. You know, a lot of Jewish people practice aspects of Jewish law. They observe the Sabbath. They keep kosher. It does not interfere in any way with them observing the laws of the United States, with them observing the Constitution, nor would they want it to. Is there an analogy that can be made to Sharia law, that there's aspects of Sharia law that a Muslim could easily practice in the United States without interfering at all with their loyalty to observing American law and the Constitution?
No, absolutely. And Muslim leaders, scholars, civic activists, and regular citizens have made this argument for a long time that, in fact, nothing about their observance of Sharia comes into conflict with being American. In these recent, there are a bunch of new surveys coming out on Muslim American thought in the United States that show that there is a comfort with being both Muslim and American, that the two are not at odds, that they don't see the two as being at odds, and that applies to, I would say that definitely applies to the way they approach Sharia. And I think that one of the kind of the driving messages that they want to put out there is that there is no conflict between being a Sharia observant Muslim and being a patriotic American. And you hear that a lot. And I think that that's a really important message that's also, you know, that's important to them that's been lost in this.
Andrea Elliott, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to be here.
Andrea Elliott is an investigative reporter for The New York Times. You'll find a link to her article, The Man Behind the Anti-Sharia Movement, on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, John Sheehan, and Heidi Simon. We have research assistance from Maria Yagoda. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.